have that meeting compensation. You know, each member is receiving $100. I'm assuming this is MTC, $500 per month per agency. And so that's been stated. And move on to consent calendar. These are items we only have on our consent calendar, the minutes from our July 13th meeting. Is there a motion to approve?
Move to approve.
Okay, you have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Mark, can you confirm that you have a quorum?
Yes.
Okay, so what is the procedures when, if ABAG doesn't have a quorum? We don't have any action items, so we'll just...
It's an information item, but I would have to defer to ABAG's counsel as to how it impacts ABAG.
Well, the minutes, I'm assuming, are the MTC planning, so we have a quorum, so we're good there. So
it's just information.
And Sam, do we have your yes vote on the minutes?
Yes.
Okay, so we did. So we have a vote on the minutes, and if there's no dissent, that motion passes unanimously. Let's move on to item number four. This is a briefing of the modeling technologies for the Bay Plan area travel model for One and Urban Sim. And who's going to present this? David, are you starting this?
Yeah, I'm. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm David Ory from MTC, and I am joined here by Michael Riley from ABAG. So at the last meeting in July over at the Scottish Rite Center, we gave an overview of the planning tools that we were going to use for the analyzing the ER alternatives. And there was some interest from both committees, the commission and the committees, to provide a little bit more detail and more information on the planning tools. So we're here today to give a somewhat technical but hopefully still mildly entertaining overview of the planning tools that we use.
Well, reduce it so we can understand it, all right?
We'll do our best.
All right.
So the two tools that we introduced at the meeting were a tool called Urban Sim and our travel model. Urban Sim is what we call a land use model. It tries to forecast land development patterns. And the travel model tries to understand travel behavior in order to predict congestion and emissions and those type of things. And we've been using ABAG's been using land use models, and MTC's been using travel models for decades. The things that are new are the type of travel model we're using. We've been using it for about 2 years now, but it's somewhat new. The Urban Sim models is fairly sophisticated, and the real advance of the two is that they're integrated. So travel outcomes influence land development patterns, and land development patterns have always influenced travel outcomes, but now we're also going the other way. So what I'd like to do, we're going to switch to two presentations that weren't in your packet that give more detail, and I'm going to talk for about 10 or 15 minutes about the travel model, and then Michael's going to talk for about 15 or 20 minutes about the Urban Sim model. Okay. And the two models have a lot in common. Their approaches are similar, so we thought we'd discuss both so you can kind of get a sense of their frameworks are similar, the philosophy behind them are similar, so we thought we'd present them in tandem. So the travel model first. The outlines of both the presentations are really quickly, what is the travel model, why do we use travel models, and then segueing into some of the details on how the travel model works. So what is the travel model? At its simplest, the travel model is a representation of supply and demand. So in this case, supply is the roadway system, the roadway network, the transit service, and the demand is people's desire to participate in activities that are in different locations, and so they travel. And when supply interacts with demand, you get price and an economic framework, and in this situation, you get congestion. If there's too much demand relative to the supply of the roadway, you get congestion, and that's what the travel model at its heart tries to do. We try to represent the supply of the system, we try to represent how people want to travel, and then we try to represent how those two things interact to get an estimate of price or congestion. The model we use, the modeling system that we use, just has a series of probabilistic models. Probabilistic meaning They're mathematical expressions that try to give you a probability of things occurring. So if you're going to work, you have the option of walking to work, some of you. You have the option of driving to work. You have the option of taking the bus. What we try to do is for each person understand what the probability of each of those outcomes is of occurring. And we use different expressions and try to understand the context of the trip, of the behavior. And once we have the probability, we roll kind of the computer dice to pick something for you. So if there's a 50% chance that you were going to take the bus, a 50% chance that you were going to take transit, we roll the computer dice and we pick one for you. And once we pick that decision, we go on to the next decision. So what the travel model is trying to do is simulate all these outcomes. And in the type of applications for regional planning, we simulate a typical weekday. Typical meaning school is in session, the weather is relatively clear, there's no major accidents on the facility, and we feel that a typical weekday is a pretty good way to judge how infrastructure and whatnot is going to perform in the future. So why do we use the travel model? We do not use the travel model to give us any answers. Kind of a mantra of modelers is that we don't provide any answers. What we hope to provide is insights. So these models generate a whole bunch of numbers. They generate very precise estimates of congestion, transit ridership, emissions. The ABAG urban sim model generates very precise estimates of land development patterns. But we're not trying to give you precise answers. What we're trying to give you is broad insights into how policies and infrastructure impact behavior. So we're trying to give you insights so that you can make decisions. We're not trying to provide precise answers. Models are generally seen to be objective. They don't live in a particular county. They don't use a particular transit service. They more or less treat every system in a somewhat fair manner. And they're also comprehensive. If you believe there's something true about how people travel that we can understand in mathematical expressions, then if we apply this framework in San Francisco, we can extend it to San Mateo, in Santa Clara, in Napa, and all the counties in the Bay Area. So if we believe there's some framework that's true, then we can easily extend it to the entire Bay Area, which makes it somewhat efficient. And it's also multi-purpose. We're usually asked to use these models to do a wide variety of things. They're originally designed to give us estimates of emissions, for us to understand how much stuff comes out of the cars so we can understand whether or not we're meeting our conformity requirements. Since then, you know, even in this plan, it's asked to talk about highway operations in terms of what would be the impact of ramp metering, what would be the impact of bridge toll increases, what would be the impact of BRT systems. So we try to make a tool as multi-purpose as we can so that we can efficiently answer the questions. So how does it work? The way the model works is it starts out and we essentially make a make-believe population of the Bay Area. So we create a big list of households and people in those households, and those people are intended to represent every person in the Bay Area. When we do forecasts, ABAG provides what they believe to be the growth pattern in the Bay Area, and we then populate households that we've observed in census data such that they match the control totals that ABAG has provided. So in the future, in 2040, when we're doing these 2040 simulations to get results, what we're doing is we're first creating a population, a list of people who we think could plausibly live in the Bay Area in 2040. And once we do that, we go through each family one by one. So I just wanted to spend about 5 minutes showing you each step that we take through, each kind of model, each choice we simulate for each family. So this is an example family. There's a mom, a dad, and the smaller people are intended to be children. I didn't have a baseball hat or a thing like that. So we've got a mom and a dad and an older son and a younger son. When we create this family, when we get this family from the census to populate our future Bay Area, we know in this case that the mom and dad both work and the older son goes to school. So we get their kind of person status from the census. We would also know if they were retired in this case based on their age or if they were too young to go to school, such as the younger boy. The first model that we apply, and again, this is a probabilistic model, the first model we apply is we try to guess where those who work and those who go to school, where they do that. So there's, again, a probability that the mom works any place in the Bay Area. In this case, the place that she works in this simulation is in the San Francisco CBD. The dad works out at Genentech, and the son just goes to school in some geography that we call a zone X. So that's the first model that we calculate probabilities for, and then we simulate outcomes, and now we know something about this make-believe family that we carry on to the next step. The next step is, now that we understand where these people live, we understand where they work, we understand their family structure, we guess how many cars they would own. And how many cars you own dictates the rest of your day. So after we have an understanding of the basic characteristics of this family, the next thing we try to do is through a series of models, build their day pattern. We want to understand what this family does on a typical day, how they travel, where do they need to go, what do they need to do. And once that travel comes together, then we can move on to forecasting outcomes. So the models here on out try to understand what they did that day. So the first model we have guesses what their daily activity pattern is. So each person in this household does one of three things. They either go to work or school, they leave the house but don't go to work or school, or they stay at home. If they stay at home, that's wonderful for the model because we're done with them for that day because they're just going to stay at home all day. In this example, the mom, who is a worker, she does not go to work. She instead stays home with her young son, which is pretty common in families, and that's something we try to capture in the model. The dad goes to work, and the son goes to school. Once we know who's making this, as a shorthand, we call work and school travel mandatory. We understand there's other travel that's mandatory. We just use that as a shorthand. Once we do that, we try to understand how many times they go to work and school. Most people just go to work or school one time, but some people do go to work, come home, and then go to another job. So we have a model that guesses that. Once we know that they are workers and students, once we know how many times they go to work, then we try to schedule their work tour. So in this example, the dad left home at 7, returned home at 7. The son left for school at 8 and returned home at 4. So now we've scheduled the work in school, which, not for everyone, but for most people, that anchors their day. That determines what they're going to do the rest of the day, whether or not they go to work or school and the time they spend there. We call non-mandatory travel any travel that's not work or school. Again, that's just a shorthand. So in this example, for this family, the mom and the little boy made two trips together. Tour is a round trip, so they left home, came back, left home, and came back. The dad left work and came back, and the older son, did something before or after school. Please.
Make sure we understand, because the assumptions are always important in all of this. So, non-mandatory travel is not a trip that's not a trip to school or to work. I mean,
correct.
As folks here who've all had kids understand, sometimes taking, you know, kids to an after school, picking them up from an after school program, or taking them to a sports event that they're participating in, or that's not considered necessarily mandatory.
Mandatory is just a shorthand label. It doesn't mean mandatory.
No, I realize that, but it's important in how we look at how this plays out in terms of these assumptions.
If we called it not work or school, there would be no difference in the assumptions. It's just a shorthand, so we don't have to use the term not work or school.
Right. But I mean, what we're trying to get at is look at this. We're trying to also understand what discretionary trips there are, because we're trying also over the long term. We're trying to reduce discretionary trips to get people to reduce VMTs.
Right.
I'm just getting to the issue of assumptions of what's discretionary and what may not be discretionary.
So if you're in the simulation, which is a simplification of the world, if you're a worker or a student, the only thing that we force you to do that day is go to work or school. We don't force anyone to do anything else. There's a probability that they would, but we don't force them to. Not sure.
Yeah, I guess I just, you know, I think about when I have to take my 8-year-old daughter to something on a Saturday, I feel forced. So I'm not sure that I just don't quite put that the same discretionary if it's like a regular activity. It's important because people will take this data and parse it, look at it. I just think it's almost like there's different categories of discretion.
Okay.
Not yes, no.
Right. And there are. If you have a child, you're much more likely to go out and take that child somewhere than if you don't have a child. Please.
Dave, can I just add something to that? Aren't you capturing those trips in the non-mandatory
category?
Absolutely. So I think it's a distinction between the two, but the trips are captured.
It's just a label. It's just a label.
It's just how people will look at this data and interpret it. And, I'm trying to have us not be criticized for how we may categorize something, because, we get criticized for many things. And trying to reduce that.
It's in quotes because I've been criticized for that exact point, so it's a point well taken. So once we generate these places, once we guess or understand how many of these non-worker school tours these folks are going on, we try to guess where they're going to go. So the mom and the son go to the zoo, they come back home, they go to the market. The dad, while at work, he goes out to McDonald's and comes back to work. And the son, before or after school, he goes to Jimmy's house. Once we know how many times they're leaving the house, where they're going, then we try to schedule that behavior. And we try to schedule it in acknowledgement of the schedule decisions that have already been made for work or school. So the mom and the little boy go out to the zoo between 8 and 11, come home for lunch and a nap. The dad goes to lunch at lunchtime, and the son goes to Jimmy's house after school but before dinner. Last series of choices here. Once we understand where they're going, what time they're going there, we guess at how they're going to get there. So are they going to drive? Are they going to walk? Are they going to take transit? And we have another model that does its best to understand the context and the options to make those decisions. So the mom and the boy drive to the zoo and then walk to the market. The dad drives to work, also drives to lunch. And the older boy takes the bus to school and then rides his bike over to Jimmy's house. And this is the decision they want to make for that entire tour. But on that tour, they may decide to make stops. So we have another model that guesses where these people may stop. And in this example, the dad stops at Starbucks on his way to work. So depending on where that Starbucks is, he could drive from home to Starbucks and then drive to work. If that Starbucks was really close to his workplace, he could drive to work and then walk over to the Starbucks. So we try to understand that sequence. So at the end of all these models, what we have is a list of people and all the trips they've made and the modes on which they travel. So we essentially have a pretty good estimate of demand, and we're ready to take that demand and interact it with the supply, meaning the roadway network and the transit network. So what we do is we aggregate that demand across everyone. So we simulate that individual family, and we also simulate 7 to 9 million other individual families, depending on the forecast year. And we put it all together, and we have a separate process to which we understand the interaction of supply and demand. In this case, that's congestion. Once we have an estimate of congestion, we do the whole thing over again, and we simulate all the families again so that they can understand the choices they're making given that estimate of congestion. We then aggregate that demand and then compute congestion again. And we do this over and over again until we reach an equilibrium. And when we reach an equilibrium, or we say we reach an equilibrium, when the choices that we simulate result in the same level of congestion in which the congestion was based, those choices were based on. So your input equals your output. The level of congestion that we show people is the same level of congestion that results from their choices. And once we have that equilibrium, we have estimates of congestion, transit ridership, which we can then turn into estimates of emissions, on and on and on. And that's all the results that you see in the EIR in our presentation. So when we show you commute tours by mode, it all emerges from all these detailed calculations. And we've been doing this, again, in one way or another for about 30 years. It's a little bit more sophisticated, not, but this is how we compute estimates of congestion and whatnot. So that's all I have on the travel model. So if you'd like to ask any more questions now, I'd be happy to take them. If not, I can turn the presentation over to Mike Riley to talk about UrbanSim and the land use model.
Well, that was really clear. I can't imagine any questions. No, we'll start with Mark.
So if I understand, then for a particular, I guess I got several different questions. So, how do you decide the types of families that you're simulating? Is that a census
type of thing?
Well, if...
Number of single families, number of...
It's both. So when ABAG does their forecast, they'll say, let's say ABAG does a forecast, and in one geography they say there's 10 families, and they'll also forecast other characteristics of people who live there, such as the age distribution of the people who live there, the income distribution of people who live there.
So census plus projections,
yep,
to say what that is. And then so in these different pieces of your model, then you're not actually obviously picking Starbucks, but there's some model that I guess looks at discretionary choices in the area and then just sort of randomly selects what one of those discretionary choices may be based on probability or...
Yeah, so in that particular example, if I'm driving to work and I want to stop and get coffee, right, so I know where I am, and it'll look out and say, okay, I know where I am and I know I'm going to work. What retail opportunities are there between those places? And what's the best place for me to stop, given the fact that I'm in a car and given the fact that I'm trying to get here?
Okay, and so presumably then part of that is a model of each of those discretionary places and how they're suited to a particular need then.
At an abstract level, yeah. It's not Starbucks, it's retail employment.
Retail with the car drive-through or something like that. Okay. Okay, so so how do you calibrate this? How do you know your assumptions are actually working?
So what we do is we do a big survey about every 10 years to understand how people travel, and then we base these models on those outcomes. So we did a big survey in 2000, and we're doing another one right now. So once we get that survey information for 2011, we'll recast these models to understand how people behave. And once we do that, instead of forecasting, we'll do what we call a backcast. We'll use this model to predict what's going to happen in the year 2000, which is convenient because we know what happened in 2000. So for this model, we collected data in 2000, and we predicted what would happen in 2000, and then we predicted what would happen in 2005, and we compared how we did.
Okay. So you basically historical data, and you model that and
yep,
see how you did. Okay.
Okay.
Scott?
Thank you. I'm really struggling to try to formulate my question, but let me take a shot at it. Due to the fact I'm in government, I guess I've kind of learned to question it more. And what I'm looking for is when you look at the model, how does the model individually treat the urban, suburban, and rural portions of the nine Bay Area counties? Does it treat it differently?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So, because my fear is that I call them Easter eggs. Are you familiar with Easter eggs?
Yeah.
They're like things that can be in programs that can kind of like blow things up or
right,
manipulate.
Right.
My concern is the Easter eggs that are being dropped into this program.
Right.
And how it could manipulate a project
right,
that a certain community wants, but maybe other communities don't want.
Right.
So could you help me? Because this is really where I become, I mean, I don't mind using Urban Sims, and I'm okay with it, but where I just become questionable about it is what I can't see.
Right. Yeah, and certainly we go to great lengths to make sure we don't introduce, well, we try very hard to not introduce any geographically based biases into the model. For example, if we observe, let's look at a model that tries to predict household auto ownership. If we observe people in San Francisco own many fewer cars than people who live in Livermore, we don't want to say there's something magical about San Francisco that causes that. What we want to say is there's something about the urban environment that causes that. It's difficult to store your car. There's more activities closer by. So in each of these models that I told you, we do our best to compare our predictions to our observations. And when we're wrong, we try to ask the question, why are we wrong? What's there? And we try not to say, oh, let's just adjust it so we get Alameda right, and let's adjust it so we get San Francisco right, not understanding that some of these places, for example, San Jose, North San Jose, might change. So we try to relate that back.
Okay, so I guess my advice to you is as we move forward with this, I mean, because I have to be honest with you. I'm no clear, and I apologize, I did walk in a few minutes late, so I did miss part of your presentation, but I'm no more clear now than when I walked into this meeting. And my assumption, or what I would say to you, and maybe just as one commissioner, maybe not the entire commission or members of the ABAG, is that you're going to really need to keep us updated on how this is unfolding.
Okay.
To think that you're going to be able to hang this out there for 6 months or 8 months or a year and then pat us on the top of the head and say, well, this is what we got, I don't know that that's going to work. And I think you're going to really develop a lot of questions. And I think you, as much as you can update us, and I'm almost saying like monthly, you need to update us and keep us very aware of what's going on, or there's going to be a significant level of distrust.
Kevin? And then Sam, did you want... Okay, and then Sam.
Thank you, Chair. I've always been curious how you go about capturing the role of technology in commute patterns. We've all heard about telecommuting, working from home. And, you know, there's going to be technology in 20 years that we simply can't envision today about, you know, bringing people together. I know that the pendulum is swinging back and, you know, there's teamwork being done together at an office site, which is preferable to working from home. But we don't know what 20 years brings. So how do you go about controlling for that, capturing that, projecting out on commute patterns? Obviously, our population will increase, but the way we work as a society is ever-evolving. So how do you go about factoring that in?
Well, I think the broader question is, yeah, there's a lot of things we don't know about the future that we have to make input assumptions on. You know, gas price being a big one. We have to guess what that's going to be. Telecommuting tendency would be another one. So the first answer is there's a whole bunch of assumptions that we have to make, and we try to be very explicit about what those are. For telecommuting in particular, if you look at the census, doesn't ask people if they telecommute, but they ask people if they work at home. So that could mean a lot of things. It could mean telecommuting. It could mean a plumber who works out of his house. It could mean someone who makes crafts and sells them on eBay. So they've been asking that question since the 70s. So you can see a pretty good trend of people who work, an increase in people who work at home between 1970, 1980, 1990, 2000, and so on. So what we do in that particular case is we extrapolate that trend. And when we have this model of whether or not people who are workers leave the house on a particular day, we adjust that model so that the number of people who leave their house to go to work who are workers more or less matches that trend. And that's kind of a general approach we try to use for a lot of things. We try to find good evidence in order to make good assumptions.
Sam?
Thanks, Chair. you mentioned that the transportation patterns are based largely on survey data. And that survey data comes out about once a decade. I assume that's survey data other than what we just get out of the census. Is that
correct? Yeah, MTC does our own survey.
So given, I think, probably all of our suspicions around self-reported data and the various biases and so forth, are we doing anything to check that? In other words, finding out if Safeway... volume is revealing that people are going to the store as little or as much as they say they are. I mean,
right?
How much do we really trust that self-reported data?
Yeah, so there's a whole industry trying to get that right. So a few of the things they do is, number one, they trust that the census is right in terms of the census does a pretty good job of accounting for everyone, which is its purpose. So when we survey people, there are certain groups who are less willing to fill out the survey. People who are busy, people who are young, and what we try to do is account for that by saying the people who in those hard-to-reach populations that do fill out the survey, we kind of assume that they represent more people than the people who are, you know, retired folks who fill out the surveys all day long, so we've got plenty of them. The other thing we do, in the effort we're doing this time, I'm working with the state, there's a very concerted effort to reach hard-to-reach populations. We try to go out to folks, just like we do with our outreach here, to get non-English speakers and other folks to participate. So it's still a problem. And I guess the third thing we do is when people fill out the surveys to tell us what you did, a lot of times they'll just get lazy and they'll just skip things. So this time around, we are giving people GPS keychains, those who volunteered, And so in addition to the reporting, we'll look at their actual tracking. So
that's interesting.
Yeah, so there's a lot of ways, but it's still the problem's still there.
Yeah, and I certainly feel reassured that, you know, people are willing to be tracked, and that's probably more reliable than anything, but I'm not sure all of us would volunteer for it. So I know you described various problems of self-reporting. I know a big one we have, certainly in my city, is just the challenge in many non-English-speaking communities and heavily immigrant communities where people simply don't want to engage in a survey for lots of reasons.
Yep.
What about just the fundamental bias that we all have when we're reporting our own behaviors? We simply get it wrong. How do we...
Right, and that's... Yeah, sometimes you report your aspirational self rather than your actual self.
Right, I go to the gym every day,
the gym only sees
me once a week. Yeah,
sure. So the good news about that is some people who report their aspirational self, the hypothesis is they would also be willing to carry around a GPS keychain in exchange for $50. And you would be amazed how privacy concerns go away when you give someone $50. So that's our first effort. But yeah, in the long run, we do our best to try to figure that out.
Thank you.
Tom?
No, this is very interesting. I'm just wondering how your batting average. How are you doing in the past projecting these things? In other words, you've been doing it for a long time. And
right.
People have been doing this. So what have we learned over the years, and how accurate are we? How's it lining up?
Well, the good thing about it being a travel modeler is you can always blame the land use modelers. Because if the land use inputs are wrong, the travel models are wrong. So our best way of knowing how we're doing is to forecast the past, to predict
right.
the past.
Right.
And the current model that we have now does a much better job at predicting the past in such a way that it hopes to not bias the future. You know, it's easy to get the past right if you introduce all these bias constants that I was mentioning. So it's hard because there's not a fixed metric, you know, but things like regional mode share and kind of the big measures, we do pretty well on.
Okay.
But there are a lot of really complicated behaviors that
What do we attribute? I understand that BART is experiencing this riding increase. What do we attribute that to?
I actually talk to BART about that every week, and we don't know. And they don't know. And they're very upset that the model doesn't capture that. So what we're trying to figure out is, what is it? Why is BART increasing? And right now, whatever's increasing BART ridership, that's one of the things the model doesn't really understand in the short term.
What about bus transportation? Is that also increasing? Or is that
absolutely, yeah. Walking, biking, busing. And
well, maybe people are finally understanding there's a problem out there and need to do something, change their personal behavior.
Mark?
You know, since Tom brought that up, it reminded me, and I, as one who doesn't practice this behavior, it's tough for me to admit it, but in this modeling coming... Well, I'll say this, you know, if you're going to have a keychain with me following me around, the key thing I want to know is, does it track speed also? If it does that, I'm going to need much more than $50 to have that tech.
Well, you are doing 55.
Some places, yeah. What I'm trying to get to is this. I've been reading that you mentioned the younger people and having difficulty filling in forms and everything else because they're probably playing games and on the phone and everything else. Is that really, from my reading, is that due to a number of things, insurance costs,
driver's license regulations.
Some places having an older age where you can even start driving by yourself or with other people in your car, and et cetera. And that people are wanting to take public transit because it allows them to keep on their gizmo, their phone, their video game, keeping, you know, constantly chatting with somebody. And how are you, and I'm seeing actually that, you know, the rate of younger people even having a driving license descending. Which is just phenomenal to me. And thinking back when I was that age, you got to be kidding me. But how are you factoring this? Sort of what Tom was saying, this sociological shift. Even though it isn't like a majority of people don't want a driver's license, but there's still that's a growing wedge of people who are just saying, I don't want to drive. because I don't like driving, not because necessarily you want to save greenhouse gases, but just because of the fact that they don't want to drive, period.
Right.
How are you seeing that evolving?
So we don't have great data on that yet. We hope in the update to the 2000 survey that we're doing, we'll get better information on that. Our modeling tools right now typically don't operate at that level of sophistication. So when we're faced with something like that, we have to make the choice of whether or not we want to go into the modeling system and assert that that will continue to become true. So in a place like telecommuting, it's fairly easy because we have really good historical data to say, yes, we think that's going to continue. In the case of this trend, you know, we have to make the judgment call. Do we think this trend is going to continue? And if so, because our modeling tools don't capture it explicitly, should we go in and make that happen? And on this particular one, we haven't done that yet. But there's dozens of judgment calls like that that we have to make.
Well, I would think, actually, that Julian, as well as others, and I heard it within the last inside this month that the telecommuting part is somewhat going to be staying static, at least according to the Bay Area Council's figures, that they think that that's actually not going to be blossoming up that much. Whereas on the other hand, this other thing I just mentioned does seem to be growing, and I would think that it would be prudent to actually at least start looking at ways to blending that into the modeling exercise.
Okay, yeah, we'll do that.
David, you made the statement, when we're wrong. I mean, when do you know you're wrong, and then what do you do with it? How do you change the modeling? And the other question is, is there ever any geographic reality check? I mean, do we look at, here's over the last 30 years, here's areas that we predicted this type of congestion. Is it actually happening?
Yeah, so to your first question, when we're developing the model, so in this next go, we'll have all this data from 2010, and we'll try to take all that detailed information and generate these somewhat elegant models to predict behavior. And then there's cases where we're wrong. So one of the instances where we were wrong earlier this year was in our base year, we underestimate muni ridership. So all else equal, we tend to not understand why people take the bus in San Francisco, but we understand why they take the bus in other places. There's just something about muni that the model didn't understand. So then we're faced with the question. One thing we could do is put in a bias constant that's specific to San Francisco and say, I don't understand this behavior, but I want to get it right. And I want to get it right so I don't get criticized. And then the other side of the argument is, I don't understand the behavior, so I don't want to bias the model, and I'm willing to say I'm wrong. And when I do a forecast, when we're in a forecasting situation, we'll say, we underestimate muni ridership. You should take that into account when you make decisions.
Okay, so that's the qualifier.
Yeah, so there's, when we write up the details, there's tons of qualifiers to say, it's not perfect. We're not predicting the future. We're trying to help you make slightly more informed decisions.
And then the last question before we go to Michael, on the geographic check reality, actually happening on the ground.
Yeah, so when we do that backcast to 2000, when we try to forecast back, we'll look at roadway segments throughout the Bay Area. And that's getting easier and easier to do because of the PIMS data and the bridges and all this information that we have now. It's getting easier and easier just to look across the Bay Area how we're doing. So, yeah, we'll focus a lot on the bridges, but we'll look at Interstate 80 as it approaches Yolo County. We'll look at 101 south of Gilroy. We'll look all over to see how it's doing.
And then do you adjust the model when you see what is actually happening?
Well, it's the same question. We have to ask ourselves, do we understand why we're underestimating ridership there? So, for example, if we're underestimating ridership on 280 south of San Francisco, we have to say, well, maybe we're getting the airport wrong. Or maybe we don't understand, you know, if the competition between I-680 and I-880, those two roads are very different, and people take them for different reasons. And do we understand that? Does the model understand that? So that's the hard part.
Yeah. All right. Well, Michael, Jim, if you're ready, let's...
No, Jim, can I ask...
Yes, go ahead. Yes,
you actually stimulated a question in my mind. How will the model interact with, say, counties that are not located within our study area? For example, you know, there's a tremendous amount of traffic that comes from Stanislaus and San Joaquin County. That doesn't even stop, for example, in Alameda County, may go to Contra Costa or to Santa Clara.
Right.
How will the model react to that?
So we do spend a lot more attention on our nine counties, and we have we try to account for them, but it's in a much simpler way. So we look at historical trends of people coming over the Altamont Pass, and we have pretty good census data, at least to where those people are going to work. So we basically say we expect more people to continue coming over the Altamont Pass, and we try to guess where in the Bay Area they're going to go. But it's at a much lower level of sophistication than what I showed here.
I guess I would suggest that might be a bit of a mistake, and the reason I say that is because if you're only just kind of laissez-faire about what's going on in the Altamont, you could be really missing something, a problem or a situation that will occur, for example, in Santa Clara County, right, as you know they start booming back and such. So I personally would like to hear a better answer than, well, we'll look at it, but we don't pay that much attention to it. I would rather hear an answer, we need to figure out a way to pay more attention to that, because, yes, that will have a strong impact on how it impacts the rest of the model. And so I don't know where we go with that, but I'm not comfortable with the answer.
Well, certainly moving forward, we could include San Joaquin County just as we do the other counties. It's just an additional level of effort.
Well, look, I'm being parochial, and you all have your,
no, I think
your
you're
counties
raising
that push up against you, but I think, you know, what happens in San Joaquin County and Stanislaus County over these next 20, 30 years will be extremely explosive. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that they're paying attention like we are. I mean, they probably are, but maybe not to the level of detail, because they probably don't have the money that we have to do these studies. And I think it would be very important that we do that. And I would, if other commissioners feel that there's a county that's pushing up against them that's going to have strong growth, I mean, like I said, I'm being parochial, but others should jump in.
And we do coordinate with the San Joaquin County MPO to make sure our estimates are in line with each other. So that's an additional check we do.
I guess I'm
looking for a cooperation
against that.
Jim?
Yes.
I'd like to go ahead. I understand
that's
that,
fine.
But I'm really concerned about a couple of statements now that have happened in response to two different questions. One was, do we understand why BART ridership is increasing? Well, no, not really, and neither does BART. Okay, so how are we accounting for that, and what are we going to do about it? Well, we don't really know yet. And Muni, we don't really understand that one either. So what about AC Transit or any of the other big transit? I mean, do we have the same thing with all the transit that we don't understand? Because if we don't understand, this doesn't make much sense to me.
I think I was being overly critical of myself there. The model has a pretty good understanding of how many people ride BART, but BART has seen quite a bit of growth in the past 3 years.
Right.
And one of the questions BART has been asking me is, do you have any insights as to why that may be? And so when we do our forecasts out to 2035, what the conversation we have with BART is, how much do we need to factor up the numbers? Because do you think this is a temporary spike in ridership, or do you think this is an enduring spike in ridership? And if it's the latter, we do have ways, and we do account for that, to make sure we get estimates of demand at the pinch points right.
And do we have answers to those questions?
Not right now. We don't.
Or about the Muni ones? And does the same thing replicate on other transit modes?
Well, it does not. We tend to do much better on most of the other transit routes, with some exceptions. There are lots of reasons why you could imagine Muni ridership being higher. Or you can imagine there's things in San Francisco that make people more likely to take the bus, all else equal, than in other places. For example, back in 2000, in 2005, you had this fast pass ownership. And so many people had a fast pass, and if the decision was to walk or take the bus and the bus showed up, your marginal cost was zero. And our model doesn't understand that kind of relationship with fast pass. The other thing is just the ubiquity of transit service. So if I get to a place and I check, is the bus coming? And with those traveler information, the next bus, you know. And if the bus is coming, I'll take the bus. If it's not, I'll just walk those two blocks. And so we think we understand the behavior. It's just, is there a way to include it in the model in a reasonable way?
Mr. Chair.
Steve.
Yeah, I wanted to make two points. One of them in response to the question about the adjoining counties. But the first point is that these demand models are primarily for comparing alternatives. They are generally not in search of the absolute truth or the absolute number. Now, one exception to that happens to be relevant here, which is this greenhouse gas target. That's a place where Dave is really trying to pick a number. But generally speaking, these models have been developed over time to evaluate alternatives. Should we build this road project or that one? Should we build a road project or a BART project? And to that extent, whatever imperfections the model has are applied evenly between the alternatives. All right. And generally speaking, those imperfections are not going to bias the result. So I think that's a very important point to keep in mind. The models certainly are not perfect. The one we have is a quantum leap from the one we used to have, and it cost us several million dollars as a result, and it really is state-of-the-art around the country. I was just at the national meeting of the MPOs around the United States, and this is where they are all moving. But there is no model that will give you the truth in 30 years. I mean, we're lucky to understand what's happening in the next five. So there is a margin of error. There's a range of results. But I think the most important thing is, generally speaking, what the models are doing is comparing things. And so the imperfections don't usually affect that comparison. Now, on the question of the adjoining counties, it's really not just San Joaquin. I mean, the nine barrier counties have 10 counties that adjoin them. And I think largely we have a resource question here. If we're going to start running a 19-county model, that's a different story. Now, is there a step or are there steps along the way where we could take better account of those adjoining counties? I think the answer is yes. Now, I don't know if we can do it on the fly in the middle of an EIR that is underway right now, but I do believe, especially in response to Commissioner Haggerty's question, that it is a place where we do need to do better, and perhaps that's one place where we can come back to you with some ideas after a suitable period of time to show you what we might be able to do and how much it would cost.
Okay. All right, let's... Okay, last question. And
I know you want to move on, Jim. I understand this is essentially more trend analysis in a sense on top of a lot that's been done by the region over the years. But I think the area to deal not only with the inter-county issue but also with the large urban area changes and issues like North San Jose would be, for example, in Stanislaus County, if there's going to be a plan that surfaces to build an enormous electric car plant there, it seems to me that we should be able, without a lot of extra work, to track those kinds of major projects, you know, going back to kind of the first step, go back to the first step on the flow chart here and say that is now something new that's going to change the trend analysis so dramatically that traffic going through Alameda to Santa Clara County, for example, is going to move. And I'm kind of understanding, hearing that's the idea within the region, and to the extent locals will help, that we even comment, or locals will modify decisions based on some of the information that would be provided. I don't think we would necessarily get Stanislaus County to change their idea about building a plant, but we can certainly, we'd certainly want to modify the trend analysis almost immediately if something like that surfaced. And I think my concern, and I don't know if it's Scott's concern, my concern would be that on the fly we can make those adjustments.
Well, and Commissioner, you're reminding me of something else, and this is something that a lot of you, all of you, in fact, I think you did it almost unanimously, have a lot to do with. The preferred scenario that you've adopted that we are now analyzing and then you'll consider finally adopting later is significantly different from the trend. The trend was a pretty steady growth in commuting, people living outside the Bay Area and commuting in. The preferred alternative you've adopted more or less cuts that trend off. It doesn't necessarily deal with all the people who are already doing it, but it says that that's not going to grow. Now, whether we can pull that off is a big question, but in a way you're making it easier for Dave because If that growth is going to stabilize and level off, then it's, I think, not so difficult to deal with the impacts of that travel. If it were to grow at the levels it grew in the 1980s, as an example, that's a completely different story. So that's a case where your policy may actually, given the fact that if you adopt the policy, that's the policy we're going to model, may actually make the job a little easier analytically.
Okay. Michael, are you ready? You could.
Morning. I'm Mike Riley with ABAG. I'll be talking about the other half of the integrated modeling system, which is the land use modeling system, which is called UrbanSim. And you can see I actually copied Dave's presentation, which was in an effort to show the basic similarities between the two modeling approaches. And to make it go hopefully a little quicker, because I know this stuff can be kind of dull, some of the technical stuff here. So I'm going to take the same basic approach, but highlight the actual differences between the two systems and you know what I'm actually looking at in the land use modeling approach. But I'm going to go through the same basic topics: what, why, how, and finish probably with the longest part, which is the questions on what I'm doing here. So first, what? This is also UrbanSim is a supply and demand approach. It's a microeconomic model. And what is being supplied and demanded is different here, and the demand is households and businesses. So again, it's households, which is very similar to what Dave is looking at. It's households, but they're not looking at transportation. Instead, they're looking at where they're going to live. So households looking at houses, either apartments, condos, or single-family homes, and businesses looking at places to put their employees, so offices, factories, warehouses, a bunch of different places. So demand is what types of square footage or housing units am I going to locate in? And supply is real estate developers providing those spaces in a given year. So again, microeconomics, supply, demand, but a different type of system. Again, like the transportation model, probabilistic models, statistical models based on observed data, but with a chance element. There's a roll of the dice involved in predicting what's going to happen in the future. And again, it's a simulation, but instead of a simulation of a given year, it's a simulation of the future city, which involves simulating a trajectory, 30 years. So we actually simulate what happens in each year of the future prediction out until 2035, because cities are a little different. They actually, space fills up over time. There's only a certain amount of space in a part of San Francisco or a part of Campbell or in Walnut Creek. So we actually, with UrbanSim, we can't just say, what does 2035 look like on a given day, which is what the travel model does. We actually simulate the year 2015, 2016, 2017, and put in a number of buildings up to what the zoning might allow and what the developer thinks they can build. So it's slightly different in the way it works, but again, a simulation out into the future. So similar framework, but some of those details you can probably already guess are pretty different from what the travel model does. Why? Jump to right away again, and I'm not going to go through all these, I'm going to skip through the basics here. No answers, same type of insights. We want to learn things about the future. What can we say about the Bay Area? Specifically, I think in this case, what can we say about the PDAs? What PDAs do we think the market might do very well in? Where will developers, where do households, first of all, want to locate on their own? What are going to be popular places to live? Where do developers, where are they likely to build in the market system? What types of places might require subsidies to get the types of development we hope to see? Those types of insights. But not answers to big questions, but just some ideas. Most important point I want to make here is that the model doesn't provide the vision. And that's something I think that's been unclear sometimes, is that this isn't a model that, Some of these models have been around, again, since the 50s, optimizing type models of the city. This model doesn't provide an idea of what the city should look like in 2035. The vision, or you know, what parts should be dense, where should we concentrate development, where should jobs go, where should housing go, that comes from the planner. You know, that's something that ABAG planners or local planners working with ABAG planners, people have to arrive at. And UrbanSim helps test those ideas, different competing visions of the future, helps us understand which ones might help achieve our goals, which ones, again, the market might be more favorable toward, or which ones we might have to help with subsidies or different planning tools. But it does not start out with that kind of idea. The vision precedes that type of work. Similar, this tool is seen as objective. It doesn't favor any kind of user group or county. Again, comprehensive. And I think that's very true, that the UrbanSim helps us amass a very large amount of data for many locations and say a lot of things about a lot of different places that we don't know much about often. I'm not going to say anything about that. Okay, this is the part I really want to focus on, because this is where we get into the details of what's actually quite different from the transportation models. How does UrbanSim actually work? But you can see, I actually copied Dave's stick figures, so I hope you're not sick of them already. But I actually drew some of my own. It didn't require a whole lot of art skill. But I copied the transport ones for the left, because just like the transport model, more or less in the same way, almost exactly in fact, we simulate households. Similar to the census, we think about the composition. We create artificial households that mirror that type of composition. They have, some of them are single households with kids. Some of them have a few kids, all types of different household compositions. And those are the households we're interested in. And, you know, households interested in what types of incomes do they have? What are their sizes? And we're interested in what types of housing units do they want. But UrbanSim also is interested in kind of the other side. We also have to simulate 28 sectors of the economy. What are the different businesses? And we take that from what's called the NETS data set, which is a data set derived from Dun & Bradstreet, which is kind of like a census of businesses. You know, like what types of firms are they? Where are they located? How large are they? How do they relate to headquarters locations? That type of information. And we also have to, we understand that data for the current year and have to simulate that information out into the future. So that's my childish stick figures on the right, that we have to understand both of those data sets. So there's a counterpoint on the business side of the spectrum. So that's supposed to be an office worker, a factory worker, a server in a restaurant, but there's heavy industry, biotech, a bunch of different sectors that are most important in the economy. So, but again, different than the transport side, we take this household structure from the census and we build probabilistic models of where do these households choose to live, what neighborhoods. And this is, again, based on observed behavior, statistical information of the types of factors that are most important to these different types of households. So households with kids are most likely to choose places with good schools. Without kids, probably access to different amenities, that commercial-type restaurant access, for instance. And the most important overriding characteristic, I would say, is income categories limit your ability to choose neighborhoods with different supplies of housing by price. All these examples are just illustrative here. I'm not picking on any particular cities, but so each of these families has chosen to live in a particular city or neighborhood. And so that's the first level choice. Second choice is a type of structure: a single-family home, multifamily, another single-family home, and then finally a tenure, owning versus renting. And again, we look at observed behavior to understand how different types of households make these choices, and then simulate in the model for each year millions of these choices. And that's done for about a fifth of the population. It's different for each income class and type of family has a certain move rate each year in the model. And about a fifth of Americans move each year, but it's different for each type of household in the model. But also new households coming in, breaking off of households or moving into the region, have to find a new location each year in the model simulation. So they choose a location. Similar on the business end. This is slightly different because it's technically not a business, it's an establishment. So it's a chunk of a business. So you can think of a McDonald's. You're locating a single McDonald's, not the entire McDonald's corporation. So technically that's called an establishment, but a piece of a business with a certain number of employees chooses a location in a particular place, Fremont, Vacaville, Uptown Oakland, and similarly a building type based on particular characteristics. And the building type here seems kind of obvious, I think. Just to point out that, you know, the office worker has gone to an office, the industrial has gone to an industrial, the server has gone to a restaurant. It's not always obvious. The server sometimes goes to a hotel, for instance, just to point out that there are some kind of differences in where different types of workers. Some office workers go to factories. There's a small office in every factory, for instance. So it gets kind of complicated. In these types of assignments. But this is, again, all based on historical data we've seen as to how these workers are sorted to different types of buildings and places. Again, millions of assignments per year in the Bay Area based on observed data and preferences for the types of locations they choose. Okay, and so, again, I think the key characteristic there is that again, a similarity to the travel model, and something that seems a little odd at first is that it's very, very micro. There's lots and lots of, you know, it might seem like, why bother? Why millions and millions? You know, very, very small choices. And I think, you know, one of the reasons is that it allows us to get very close to the true level at which choices are made and understand, you know, build a model close to how the actual choice is made in the real world, and that seems to lead to better results. But that's certainly not what we really care about. You know, we don't care about all this detail. And what we start to do after we you know, leave the computer running for a long time making these choices in a given year is that we aggregate. What we really care about is we start to take each of these neighborhoods in the model and we start to look at aggregate demand, all of these different people choosing a particular type. So in Petaluma, all the people in a given year choosing a single-family dwelling in Petaluma, a multifamily dwelling in Soma, a single-family dwelling in Campbell, a Fremont office, etc. All the different types in all the different neighborhoods or zones of the model. Those are aggregated up. People are choosing the different types of floor space or units in particular neighborhoods of the Bay Area. And you find that in some places, in many places in the Bay Area, there's what you could call kind of an informal way, there's extra demand or very high demand for particular places. Maybe I'll pick on one like Palo Alto, for instance. Palo Alto has very high demand for everything. A lot of people want to be there to do a lot of things. And in a given year, there's not let's just say in a given day, at least, the amount of floor space or units does not change in Palo Alto, right? It's constant. And so if there's a lot of people wanting to be there, you find that the price for that space increases. And we know that it gets very high in Palo Alto. It goes up. And that's the basic microeconomic relationship. So we start to see that, is there extra demand or high price in some of these places? Is there more demand than there is supply for a particular type of space, a type of unit, or a particular type of square footage in that place? Is there more demand than there is supply? And again, not to pick on anyone, but in most of these, yes. But Fremont office, in this given year I'm looking at, all this means is that there was already enough office in Fremont. Someone had already happened to build a lot of office in Fremont. maybe there's already a lot of demand, but there's just already a bunch of buildings. They just finished a whole bunch in the last few years. So there's a lot of demand going on because all these different households and firms or business establishments have sorted themselves out where they want to be based on their preferences or the model's understanding of their preferences. And we've gone through this first stage, and we have high demand in particular places or extra demand. People want to be in these places. And then we can filter this through. We can start to say that another stick figure, which I haven't drawn because I was worried that people would start to get sick of the stick figures. And it actually took me a while to draw those three. Another stick figure, because it actually is represented in the program, again, in this very small way. We have a sub-program that shows up and starts to assess very small parcels in the model, going, okay, what does the zoning look like in these places, in Petaluma, in Soma? How does it allow me to build more buildings in these places? Because I know that in this model representation, there's demand. People want to be in these places. Some of the places are zoned pretty tight. In Petaluma, no, there's not enough zoning to build more. And this is trying to represent what actually happens in the real world. Soma, there's plenty. I can build more multifamily. Campbell, no. Then the developer looks, but even if there's enough zoning space, that doesn't mean that the developer can make a profit, because the developer still might be able to go invest his money in a bank account and still do better. The model actually checks, and at this point, the model checks in a very detailed level, considering a bunch of factors, looking at the actual space on a parcel level in the model. It looks at the demand supplied by the actual households in that actual zone. Households or establishments, all split up by different building types and demand sectors. It looks at those demands, the individual parcel dimensions and sizes, what's on them currently, the current existing buildings or vacant lots, the parcels, and applies what's called a pro forma, which is the typical tool that developers use in the real world, a spreadsheet. And you can imagine a real developer going out there with an iPad and kind of looks at this, on their spreadsheet and says, can I make enough profit to build a real project here? And the model does this tens of thousands of times per year in UrbanSim and says, can I do this? And tries to build a building in each given year. And you can see that a bunch of them drop out. And then if they can, a development shows up. But the model also takes a while. It takes a few years to build the actual building, the UrbanSim, because especially in the Bay Area, but in most places in America, it takes quite a while to get a project built. And some of the conditions change. And that's something that's odd about cities. But things change, and the model takes a while to catch up. The prices might get higher. And that's kind of the heart of the developer model. It's a little very micro. Again, thinks about this, sees is there the ability to make this profit? Can I make it work? Looks at the demand from the different sectors, both households and businesses. Looks at the zoning. Looks at what's on the parcels. Figures out, can it make a profit? Very much the way a developer in the real world would think about this. Had to throw in a map. Again, reminds you that this is done with map with no. I used to teach GIS. This is a bad map. There's no title. There's no legend. This is downtown San Francisco, and it reminds you that this does occur. One of the other misconceptions I think is that this model does work at the parcel level, and again, similar to working with these individual households and firms. We don't really care about the parcels. We work at the parcel level because the parcels are what it's useful to model parcels and buildings, because that's what households and firms choose. Those are the kind of things that have the characteristics that households and firms are interested in, the prices and the attributes, the information, the types of things that firms and households are interested in. They also happen to be a lot of databases that provide information about buildings, and zoning occurs at the parcel level. So we can get all this data. The bad part is it takes a long time to build a database, and it can computer is slow. But what we want to do is crunch it up, and we actually aggregate everything up to the TAZs, which are in blue. And that's the lowest level of resolution we'd ever care about, is these blue zones, which is how we pass the information to the travel model. And often we care about much larger levels of aggregation, like the county or the whole region together. But we do the model, similar to the travel model, operates at a very micro level and then gets aggregated up. So in conclusion, the way to look at it overall is that there's this very micro-scale simulation of households and firms making choices, and those generate what's called aggregate neighborhood or zonal demand. What do they want in terms of, you know, how do their choices sum up to a total demand at this zone level? That leads to rents and prices. Does that drive up the price of single family dwelling, or rent for an apartment, or rent for square footage of an office space? That may lead to development activity by the developer, which is the supply side. That's how we generate for the future urban pattern. And that moves back to Dave's side of it, which is why it's in italics. And that future urban pattern generated over the 30 years is the relationship between the locations of households and firms, businesses, is how we look at changes in congestion and transit ridership. So this model technically is called a partial equilibrium model. So again, slightly different than Dave's model, because it doesn't ever reach an equilibrium in 1 year. It has that slow lag over time. And so I know there'll be questions, and if I, you know, so.
Okay, Mark Green.
As you sigh about, you know, there's going to be questions. I'm wondering on this model, getting to the PDAs, where many of us, including myself, believe that we have certainly perhaps even an overabundance of them on paper, and wonder about the feasibility, the viability, the reality of many of these. And I'm curious as to whether or not what your attack is going to be on trying to filter out the wheat from the chaff on those. If you're talking about how you went through that metric there about can a developer make a profit, is it zoned properly, is there community will, on and on and on. And the amount of information that you currently have versus what you're going to be needing to engage with in what I would call direct dialogue with the developers on an anecdotal basis, so to speak, versus what you have in the metric in terms of finding out which one of these are merely hallucinations of staff members and politicians versus ones that we might actually see within the next 10 to 15 years. I'm wondering what your approach is going to be on in that realm.
Oh, isn't as to like the feasibility of PDAs?
Yeah. Well, trying to figure out is, you know, you mentioned about how you had all kinds of cities, single family, industrials, on and on and on, multifamily housing. How are you going to be looking at, you know, again, we have 200 of these around the Bay Area. At some point, some of us up here, I'm not sure if it's all, but some of us up here, as well as I think people that may or may not be in the audience today, are wondering how many of these are real, how many are just pipe dreams. And it comes down to allocating resources, because what we don't need to be doing publicly is giving areas a lot of resources and then we get no results out of it.
Chair Spearing, if I may, I'd like to try to answer your question. Working with the Business Coalition, as you're all aware, this has been a concern of the Business Coalition. They've come to these meetings and spoken about it quite a bit. We actually are just embarking on a study and analysis that builds upon the PDA assessment work that was done a few years back, looks at a subset of likely 20 priority development areas that represent sort of a range of place types, communities, stronger markets, weak markets, and tries to answer the very questions you're talking about. So we're embarking on that, I believe, next week, and we'll be bringing back the results of that analysis to you later this year. So that's going to get to a lot of the questions that you're raising in terms of...
I guess, Ken, what I'm trying to get at here is besides the technical modeling data that you have already, how much more interaction are you going to be having with the development community per se?
Well, this builds upon a lot of work that took place a few years ago in the PDA assessment. This is taking a much more detailed look. We'll be working with a small group of developers to look at the results and sort of get their take on that. But it's intended to do precisely, you know, what you're talking about, to really look at what are the stronger market priority development areas that are really essentially ready to go based upon infrastructure and the planning that's been done and so forth. What are the priority development areas that need more investment, will likely need more subsidy, particularly in the wake of the loss of redevelopment? Those are the kinds of questions we're going to try to answer with this analysis.
Okay.
Also, in the longer term, we are setting up the developer of Urban Sim is a professor at Berkeley, and he's setting up a team of developers to oversee the development of the model, to ensure that they support the parameters and assumptions that underlay it. So in a longer term, we're looking at that. I don't know if that's what you're asking. I don't know, the very long term. And the person that led the development of the development portion, the last unshown stick figure, was a developer and has now gone into Haas real estate program. So he was in the private sector himself.
Okay, well, thank you, David and Michael. What I got out of this, if you want to invest in industrial and make a profit, you need to look at Vacaville. So with that said, I have no speaker cards, and so if there's no other... Tom, do you have...
Go ahead, Tom. Really quick question. So are you looking at applications for development? In other words, you know, the activity levels that are taking place in the various cities and counties? My question, in other words, people apply for various proposals and jobs, or excuse me, buildings, and it takes anywhere from 3 to 5 years before they actually come to fruition.
Yeah, so we do look at the timeline by city and kind of figure that into the cost process as an effort to like understand that in each city. Is that?
I was thinking more like the activity level, like. You know, what we're finding in my community, suddenly, I don't know what's happened, but suddenly we're just getting overwhelmed with applications. That, you know, it's been really quiet, and all of a sudden it's like...
For activity level, we have not looked at that. We only have looked at, historically, what gets built. We honestly have not looked at the very recent last 2 years because it's been pretty hard to understand. Maybe it's similar to what's happening to BART. Maybe it's the same type of mysterious forces. But no, we haven't looked at that specifically.
Okay. Go ahead, Mark.
So to what degree does it factor in the global climate, the global economic climate? So obviously you have a worldwide recession or whatever. You've got a different level of activity and opportunity. Did you just sort of assume a certain level and model based on that, or how do you take that into account?
It does not. It is driven by the rate of development is driven by the ABAG control totals. So the regional health of the economy is driven purely by ABAG's demographic and economic numbers, which I think make a statement about the health of the global economy. And so there are other ways to do it, but currently Urban Sim only allocates growth within the region. So it responds to those only. Yeah.
Okay, one last question so we can get on to our other committee meetings. Jake?
I'm mindful of that, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Jake McKenzie, representing Sonoma County. I just have to say anecdotally that it would be interesting to know how you dealt or how the model would have dealt with the city of Roanoke Park, which established a general plan update in the year 2000. We anticipated building 225 housing units per year. Over the last 12 years, with 5 specific plan areas where we've annexed and done everything, zero houses have been built, and in fact our population has declined slightly. That, as I remember the models of yesteryear, was totally contraindicated. And so And it also, to me, still represents the more outlying counties that our rate of economic recovery has not matched, say, the rate of economic recovery in Santa Clara County. So is your model capable of distinguishing what continues to happen, say, in Sonoma County?
Well, this application is brand new. And AVAG's last land use model was built in 1983. But we have decided to go back to 1945, as Dave was talking about, and see how well this model performs in the Bay Area. So I will get back to you. And I'm sure it will not do that. You know, it's going to miss a lot of things. And so it's pretty hard to, you know, predict the past. So it'll teach us a good lesson about how bad we're going to do in the future. We go back to World War II and see how good we do predicting today. So I'll get back to you on that.
I appreciate that. Thank you for your courtesy, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, David Michael. I have no speaker cards for public comments. If there's no further discussion, the meeting's adjourned. Thank you. And let the record show that we did have a quorum of both committees.
Could I have the gavel?